Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes of the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you go to the events page if you haven't done so already. If you live in the Las Vegas area, in the Nevada area, in Southern California, in New Mexico, any of those places, make sure you register for the Here We Still Stand conference in Las Vegas, October 15th and 16th. By the time this releases, it'll be like 2 weeks away. We would love to hang out with you. It's only $65 to come hang out with us for 2 days. It includes your lunch on Saturday. It's going to be a good time. Chad will be there. I'll be there. It's going to be a lot of fun. You still have time. So go ahead and grab those tickets, and we'll see you there. Chad, we're continuing through 2 Samuel. We're in 2 Samuel 22. Today, and we're continuing on this sort of look back, as it were. So we're still going kind of back in time in 2 Samuel. This is the etc. portion, and today we have another thing where we're going to revisit the life of David, and this time and not like a story, but in song or poetry.
Yeah, we're going to do a little poetry today. We haven't had a ton of chances to do that in this podcast. I know we will. We'll have a bunch of chances to do that in the coming months and years as we get to more poetry. But, we looked at some sections, and there's some poetry in Exodus. There's some poetry in Deuteronomy. There's poetry kind of scattered here and there. And, when we first started the books of Samuel, we had the Song of Hannah, which is very much kind of like what I think of it as the Old Testament version of the Magnificat of Mary's song, because there's a lot of parallels between not just the songs, but also the women themselves. So we have, we've dipped our toe into poetry, but we haven't done it a bunch. So here's our chance to shift from a narrative and talk about guys with, six fingers and six toes and killing giants and all that fun stuff to some very elevated, graphic, colorful imagery that David uses to describe his, not just his victories, but the way that God is behind his victories. There's some real kind of literally earth-shattering, earth-shaking imagery that David uses here.
One of the things that's kind of nice about this sort of look back is, as we've gone through the life of David, we've said a couple times, like, David doesn't sort of get better and better and better, but it gets worse and worse and worse as David goes along. And so it's kind of nice that at the end of the book here, you have this sort of song that makes you remember who David was and where he came from. And because this is a song that takes you all the way back to his days of running from Saul and being persecuted by Saul. And it is a little bit of a reminder about the heart of David. It takes you back, and you get to sort of remove like all the Bathsheba, all the kid stuff, all the bad decisions, and remember that this is the same guy.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, so if you've been following along with us up to this point, then you've seen David kind of falling apart. He's come unraveled, beginning with his ogling on the rooftop of Bathsheba. And that from that point on, we've just seen David piece by piece fall apart, come unraveled, get worse and worse. And so, this is a chance for us to go back and to kind of recapture that earlier vision we had of David, and to see how this, and this is the part, I guess, that fascinates me the most about chapters like 2 Samuel, to hear how there's a retelling of the story, but a very different sort of retelling. I mean, not just in the genre, this is poetry instead of prose, but it's very much of a kind of a poetic, very intensely theological retelling of the story that we don't always have in the prose. So for instance, when you read about David's conquering of Goliath, or you read about him successfully averting the hunt of Saul, whatever it might be, there's not a ton of theologizing that goes on in those narratives. I mean, there is some, there is some, of course, it's scattered here and there, but a lot of times you'll just kind of have this bare bones account of this battle happened, or this persecution was happening and David got free and whatnot. And there's no, 5-10 verse section which interprets what was happening theologically. And we get to 2 Samuel 22, And that's exactly what you have. I mean, this whole thing is basically a musical theologizing of what was happening in all those earlier years of David's life. And so it's interesting in that respect, and also the fact that in the Bible, and this happens frequently in the Bible, it is through the poetry that we have this theology taking place. And of course, this is done preeminently in the Book of Psalms, which is in many ways the most theological book in the Old Testament.
Well, it presents the most theology. It's the most quoted book in the New Testament.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So, it's not only literally in the heart of the Bible, but it really is the heart of the Bible. And it's the heart theologically, Christologically, as well as just the way it's expressed poetically.
I've always said this about hymns and songs, you know, the songs that we sing. You know, Chad, you've written hymns, I've written hymns. And one of the reasons why I'm picky about hymns is because they are memorable. It's you don't remember every word, you know, of a sermon that you heard, but you can sing the hymns that we sing without the words even being, you know, in a book or on a screen. Someone could just start singing it and you can know all the words. And so there are these little mini sermons that you remember, that you have memorized. Kids can memorize them and all this kind of stuff. And I think that one of the reasons you see the Psalms quoted in the New Testament and passages like this, quote, you know, because they're ingrained in the heads and hearts of people. They're the things that they remember. It's the poetry that they memorize, the songs that they sang. And so it's important that they be deeply theological and that they be theologically accurate. You don't want to just skip over those type of things in the scriptures.
Yeah, the theology of teachers and preachers throughout the ages has always been expressed poetically. That's one of the things that you see Old Testament, New Testament, early church as well. When you were talking, I was reminded of the fact that one of the early church heretics, Arius, the one who said there was a time when the Son of God did not exist, that he was basically a creation of the Father. Arius himself composed hymns in order that his teaching, that is to say his false teaching, could be spread more pervasively. Because, you know, if you take any doctrine and you translate it into verse and put it in the mouths of people, like you said, it's going to be more easily remembered. So this has been done not only by Orthodox, but also by heretical teachers throughout the centuries. So that's why, in other words, the Psalms are so important. The hymns are so important. Songs are so important. They're not there for entertainment purposes, but they're there for proclamation purposes. So as a kind of a preamble to this, let's see what David has to say. We have an introduction. That's verse 1. David spoke to the Lord the words of this song on the day when the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. So that, of course, that reference back to Saul is what we were referring to earlier. This has taken us back earlier in David's life. But it is really kind of a panoramic view of everything that happened to David. So this isn't concerned just with the persecutions by Saul, but it's by all of his enemies, both those who were kind of the cohorts of Saul, as well as others who, in one way or another, threatened David's life, as well as David's reign. And this opening introduction, this opening verse, really sets the theme for what we're going to see, because it says David spoke these words on the day when the Lord delivered him. So this is all about the deliverance, the salvation, the redemption, which God works for David. So David, of course, was a very smart warrior. He was a very accomplished soldier. But ultimately, his deliverance was not based upon his own experience or skill, but it was based upon God's actions on his behalf. So we start out in these first couple of verses, verses 2 through 4, with a heaping up of various images for God. We have the Lord is my rock, my fortress, my deliverer. A lot of these come in pairs of three. So rock, fortress, deliverer. My God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield, the horn of my salvation. So rock, fortress, deliverer. And then again, rock or rock of refuge. He's a shield. He's the horn of my salvation. Then we have three more. He's my stronghold. He's my refuge. He's my savior. And this kind of heaping up of images is not unusual in the rest of biblical poetry. we're starting out here with all of these various, some more abstract, but many of them very concrete images for how God as the deliverer actually brings us about. So he's pictured as a fortress. I mean, I can't hear that without thinking of a mighty fortress by Martin Luther, you know, which isn't based on this, it's based on Psalm 45, but it's still kind of, I mean, Psalm 46, but it's kind of the same idea that God is this castle or fortress in which we find refuge. And then we have these very militaristic images of like a shield. So he's there to protect us. Horn, the horn of my salvation. We actually heard that way back in the Song of Hannah, beginning of 1 Samuel, this picture of a horn. Horn, not meaning like a trumpet here, but the horn of salvation, like an animal would use its horn to defend itself or to attack, kind of as a bodily weapon, if you will. So God is the our saving horn, as well as our stronghold and refuge. Also, interestingly, a gathering together words of that all have as their root salvation. So he's the horn of my salvation. It goes on to say he's my savior. You save me from violence. At the end of verse 4, I am saved from my enemies. All those in Hebrew are from the verb yasha, which is the typical word. It's the word from which we get the Hebrew name of Jesus, Joshua. And it's the word that we see all over the Old Testament for how God saves his people. It's also, to me, interesting to point out that, you know, if you ask a Christian today, are you saved? Of course, they're going to think a very specific thing. They're going to think of spiritual salvation, salvation in Jesus. But if you look at the broad perspective of the biblical story, very often to be saved is interpreted and meant quite literally. So like if you are saved from an accident or you're saved from an attack or you're saved from whatever physical condition you find yourself, whatever physical dangerous condition you find yourself in, you are yashad. So that is part of the kind of the background here of what we think of as salvation in the New Testament. It's a spiritual deliverance to be sure, but it also has this physical component to it. So Christ doesn't come just to save our souls, but he comes to save us in our entirety of who we are. And that is based upon this deep rootedness of physical deliverance, physical salvation that we find throughout the Old Testament.
Yeah, I mean, David is saying that he was quite literally saved from the hand of Saul.
Yes.
This is not a spiritual salvation. This is quite literally
Life was in danger.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And I think that this might sound weird, but I think we overly spiritualize most things, and because we're Gnostics at heart, and so
it's true.
When we say saved, we're thinking about some kind of spiritual thing, and we're like saved from the devil or something like this. And but even in a Christian context, when you say that I'm saved, well, what I'm saved from is death.
Yeah, literally,
right? I am literally saved. Because of what God has done in Christ, I'm going to physically, not spiritually, but physically live forever. And so this is an actual saving of my life.
I think it was Eugene Peterson who said we're always trying to be more spiritual than God.
Yeah,
that is so true. We're always hyper spiritualizing everything. But yeah, the more you sink yourself into Psalms like this and the stories that we've been covering and just the ministry of Jesus. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is he doing? Is he going around just saving people's souls? No, he's like actually healing people. He's raising the dead. He's rescuing his disciples who are caught in the midst of a storm. He's feeding people who are hungry. So he's always helping people out, not just according to their souls, but physically, so that physicality of the salvation of Jesus is very often kind of eclipsed by this focus on the super spiritual or the soul focus that we so often lean into.
Yeah, you see that with Lazarus when Jesus comes up and he says that, hey, I'm going to raise him up, and they're like, yeah, we know there's going to be like a spiritual kind of resurrection or whatever, and Jesus says, no, how about right now, like physically, and this is absolutely what Jesus does. I mean, when God shows up on the scene, it's not just like some spiritual warfare going on, but when God shows up on the scene, people are being fed, diseases are being healed, dead are being raised. I mean, it's all quite physical.
Yeah, yeah, it's all the kind of the Isaiah 35 that Jesus himself refers to in the Gospel of Matthew. You know, go back and tell John what you see and hear. Mm-hmm. Well, the blind see, the deaf hear, the lame walk, all these very physical kind of new creations are happening, just like Isaiah said they would when the Messiah came. Okay, so that's the introduction. So he shifts from that to talk of, how to describe it? He's using images, kind of two different images, two different metaphors, we might say. One is a watery image, or oceanic, we might say, image, and the other is of ropes or cords. So 5 and 6 use kind of are pulling these two things together. So first of all, he talks about these waves of death that encompassed him, and or breakers, it's sometimes translated, but literally it's talking about waves, like waves of the ocean. If you've ever been in the Gulf of Mexico or the ocean, where you have strong waves and strong wind, those breakers coming on, that's the idea. These are like our breakers or waves of death that are coming over David. And then he uses the language of torrents of destruction, or more literally, rivers of destruction. So both of these, of course, are water images. And then he describes, and he shifts, and he talks about the ropes or the cords of Sheol entangling him. So first of all, he has these water coming over him, and if that's not bad enough, now he's got ropes wrapped around him, and he describes the snares of death that are confronting him. So the water imagery is pretty common in the rest of the book of Psalms too, this idea of being trapped in the waves, being caught in the seas, of sinking down. Jonah uses the same imagery in his prayer, where the breakers are coming on top of you, and then you have some sort of deadly ropes or snares sometimes that are wrapped around you. Of course, you get the image. This is poetic imagery for things not looking good. Completely overwhelmed.
Yeah, you know, he's describing how much he needs somebody outside of him to save him. You go try to stop the ocean from beating you to death when it's in the midst of a storm. I mean, this is what he's doing here. Is he's saying, I'm in a situation that I cannot do anything about. Like I can't stop the waves. And these happen to be waves of death. That's what he's getting at, right? Is that I'm going to need something external. He's painting a picture of the situation that he found himself in, and he's going to need to call on somebody else. David's a dude that's pretty good at fighting, and you know, he's a good warrior. But he's describing here a situation that he is not going to be able to overcome.
Yeah, yeah. There's always situations in which David realizes, hey, I have a lot of prowess, a lot of military skill, but there's no way I'm getting out of this. Mm-hmm. The only way that this is going to happen is by divine assistance. So what does he do? Verse 7 says, in my distress, I called upon the Lord. That's always a good thing to do. anytime you're in these situations, yeah, well then reach out to the very one who can rescue you. In my distress, I called upon the Lord. To my God, I called. From his temple, he heard my voice, and my cry came to his ears. There's a parallel there between divine ears and the temple, which is not accidental. I checked this morning to, I was thinking my memory was correct, and it was. If you look in Solomon's prayer at the dedication of the temple in 2 Chronicles 6:40, he talks about the temple. This is all about the dedication of the temple. But he talks about how God's ears are attentive to his prayer at this place. So there is this idea of God's eyes and ears being in the temple. So if you're familiar with Solomon's prayer at the dedication of the temple, he talks about how when people are caught in famine, or when they're in prison, or when they're exiled, or whatever their bad situation might be, to turn and pray toward the temple. Why? Because that's where God has promised to be. That's where his ears and eyes are. So he hears from the temple. He sees from the temple. So David is incorporating that imagery here. From his temple, he heard my voice, and my cry came to his ears. Now, as a as a Christian, when I hear things like that, my mind immediately goes to John 2 and the actual temple with ears.
Yeah.
Christ says, my body is the temple. So our temple actually does have ears and eyes that see and that hear. So when we cry out to Jesus, his ears are attentive to our cry. He sees because he is our incarnate temple. So David cries out, and how does God respond? Now, this is in many ways actually my favorite part of the psalm, because you have this, it's kind of apocalyptic language. I don't know how else to describe it, of God opening up the heavens and coming down. And the images here are just unforgettable. So David's trapped, and these billows are coming over him. These waves are encompassing him. He's all tied up. He can't do anything. So he cries out to God. And what does God do? God just breaks loose from heaven and comes down, and there's this cosmopolitan, because the whole world is involved here, and earth-shaking response on the part of God. So the earth reels and rocks. The foundations of the heaven tremble. They quake because God was angry. Why is he angry? Well, because his servant is being persecuted. So verse 9 makes me think of a dragon. Smoke went up out of his nostrils, devouring fire from his mouth, glowing coals flamed forth from him. Not the typical image we have of God, but that's the way David is describing him here.
Yeah, it's interesting that David is in distress. He calls out to God, and God gets angry on his behalf.
Yeah.
You don't think much to ask God, I'm going to need you to get angry for me here. I'm going through it, and I'm going to need you to come rescue me. And In this rescuing, God is upset.
Yeah. They're messing with his beloved. Mm-hmm. So, and he's not going to simply kind of snap his fingers from heaven and make everything better. He's actually going to show up in person. And when he shows up, the whole world's going to know it. So we have this idea of fire and smoke coming out of God because he's angry, which is the Hebrew way of expressing anger is to talk about a heated nose. So he was angry, he was hot, and here's how this anger was expressed: in smoke and in fire and glowing coals. And then he bends, or he bows the heavens, and he descends. He comes down, and there's thick darkness that's under his feet. So I kind of picture him ripping heaven open. He's coming down, he's descending with all these thick clouds. But then we shift the image. He's not just coming down, he has saddled a cherub, and he's riding it. It says he rode upon a cherub. And he flew. He was seen on the wings of the wind. So God has mounted his stallion, except in this case, it's a cherub. That blows to pieces this idea of our precious moments, cherubs, you know, those cute little pudgy things that are fragile. No, cherubs are like divine warriors. And this one is pictured as the mount of God. He's flying in on this cherub to rescue his servant.
Yeah, you got an image of a dragon riding an angel here. It's pretty, yeah, pretty intense.
Yeah, get that in your mind. Wow. We totally need a stained glass somewhere where God pictured as a dragon riding on an angel. What an image. He's got darkness around him like a canopy or a tent, thick clouds, gathering of waters. Then we have more images of coals of fire and brightness. And then it shifts to kind of storm imagery, which is also very common in the Psalms, with God thundering from the heavens, uttering his voice. He's sending out arrows. Arrows is paralleled here with lightning, which, you know, makes sense. This is actually a pretty common pairing in Hebrew poetry, where arrows are pictured as, or lightning rather, is described as an arrow that God shoots downward. So he's sending these arrows of lightning downward. And then verse 16 reminds me of two things: creation and then the Exodus, the crossing of the sea, because it says the channels of the sea were seen, the foundations of the world were laid bare at the blast of the breath of God's nostrils. So just like in Genesis 1, God parted the waters from dry land, he made a separation. That's imagery here. And then the same thing, of course, happens in Exodus 14 when Israel crosses the Red Sea. God, from this wind or spirit that he sends, he makes a division in the waters. So at the blast of the breath of God's nostrils, he makes a way for David. He makes this exodus sort of escape for him in the midst of his tribulation.
Yeah, here you have sort of like the power of the word of God, right? Because you have the channels of the sea were seen. In other words, you don't usually see those. They're usually covered up with water, but they're all split, and the foundations of the world are laid bare. You know, it says at the rebuke of the Lord. So you have this God rebuking what is going on, and this causes all of these things to happen. So what God says happens. You have David understanding that with a word, God can do whatever he wants.
And this is, and keep in mind, this is David's poetic interpretation of how God delivered him from all of his distresses. So did David actually see God as a dragon riding on an angel? Did he see these coals blasted from the nostrils of God? Did he see these channels of water? No, he didn't see that. But this is his poetic interpretation of what divine deliverance looks like.
Yep.
And so it tells you that when David was trapped, this is what God was doing. He was literally moving heaven and earth to rescue David. And then he kind of continues with some of the same stuff. He says, verse 17, he sent from on high. He took me. He literally, in Hebrew, we might say he Mosesed me out of the water. So in the ESV, it says he drew me out of many waters. The Hebrew verb there is mashah. And if you think back to Exodus chapter 2, when Moses was named by the daughter of Pharaoh, it says she named him Moshe, Moses, because she said, I drew him out of the water. So the verb mashah, from which we get the name of Moses, means to draw out. So that's the same verb that David uses here. He Mosesed me out of the waters. He drew me out of the waters. So another Exodus allusion going on here. And then he sums this section up by saying, he rescued me from my enemy, from those who hated me, because they were too mighty for me. They confronted me in the day of my calamity, but the Lord was my support. He brought me out into a broad place. He rescued me because he delighted in me. So we have David threatened. He's got the waters. He's got the ropes of Sheol wrapped around him. He calls out to God. God comes down with this apocalyptic kind of scene. He rescues him, brings him out of this calamity because he delights in him. Now, verses 21 through 25 are a unit which needs a little bit of explanation. So, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, this starts with a phrase that you're like, that can't be right. And knowing what we know, that certainly can't be right. There must be something else going on here.
Yeah, yes. So it's sort of a bookend here, because it's going to begin in 21, we're talking about my righteousness, and then it's going to end in verse 25 with my righteousness. So let me just read quickly through this. This is 21 through 25. The Lord has dealt with me according to my righteousness. According to the cleanness of my hands, he rewarded me. For I have kept the ways of the Lord and have not wickedly departed from my God. For all his rules were before me, and from his statutes I did not turn aside. I was blameless before him, and I kept myself from guilt. And the Lord has rewarded me according to my righteousness, according to my cleanness in his sight.
Now this is one of the reasons that this is kind of nice that this is on the back end of this book, because you know that in and of David's own person, that none of this is true.
Yeah, if you know anything about David, you're like, righteousness? Cleanness in my hands? What?
Yeah, like, I mean, you can't say like all his rules are before me and I did not turn aside ever. Like, we know that's not true. I've kept myself from guilt. We know that's not true. David himself will say that he needs to be saved from blood guiltiness, right? And so I think the most important words in this section are the words in his sight.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, in his eyes, literally, is the way that ends, according to my cleanness in his eyes. So this is the way, in other words, that God views David. Now, why would God view David that way? Why would he view him according to this righteousness and the cleanness of his hands and all the various ways that David describes him? It's because he's viewing him not just as David, but he's viewing him in light of the one in whom David himself trusted. He's viewing him in light of the very seed that was promised back in 2 Samuel chapter 7. You know, we could say the same thing. I could say the Lord has dealt with me according to my righteousness, according to my cleanness in his eyes, because we can, as Paul sometimes will say, we can make our boast in the righteousness of Christ, or we can make our boast in the grace of Christ. So this wasn't sort of David's own personally merited, personally acquired works righteousness that he's talking about here, but this is the way that God views him through his son.
The thing that makes it awesome that David is saying this is because David is essentially saying that God is treating me according to the son of David. David is being treated as if he was his son, which of course he's not. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting that on 30 Minutes in the New Testament, we're going through Mark, and you have this thing that Jesus does to sort of confuse the religious leaders, where he talks about whose son is David, and how is it that David calls his own son Lord?
Lord.
In other words, how is the son of David called Lord by David? How does this all work? Well, it works because David understands that the son of David is the everlasting God. And so he knows it in writing things like this and saying things like this, that he is being treated according to his Lord, who is also his son.
Yeah. And another way, just to kind of add to that, that it's helpful to kind of understand these verses, is in light of kind of the bigger picture of all Psalms like this. So this, I think I mentioned this on the last podcast. I didn't mention it today, but 2 Samuel 22, this Psalm that we're going over, is basically identical to Psalm 18. So it just is, there's a few spelling and grammatical differences, but it's basically replicated in Psalm 18. And as with Psalm 18, so with all the Psalms, you'll frequently have this language like we just talked about, and you're thinking, how does that really fit with David? Doesn't it fit more perfectly with the son of David? And you're like, that's the point of a lot of these Psalms. You'll have this hyperbolic language that's used about my righteousness and all these kind of things that we're describing that are hyperbole, but in the mouth of Jesus, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I mean, this entire psalm or this entire song could be come from the mouth of Jesus standing outside the tomb.
Yes.
I mean, absolutely. And what's great about this is that because of everything you know about David, these verses, sort of 21 through 25, because you know David is a great kind of sinner, and he can say this, then you know that great kind of sinners like us can also say this. I mean, you have permission to say these things, that God is going to deliver you and treat you according to your righteousness. And it's interesting that he says, you know, that he does own it, where he says, it's my righteousness, and that I'm blameless before him. It's not simply sort of this sort of God putting on his Jesus glasses and choosing to view you as something you're not. I don't like it when people talk about that, you know, like that, where, you know, sometimes you'll hear it. I understand it when they say, you know, when God looks at you, he sees Christ. Kind of. What he sees is the righteousness of Christ that was given to you, and now God counts as yours. So it's not simply God like doing like a parlor trick where God decides that I'm going to see you as something you're not, but that he treats you according to what you've been given and what actually belongs to you, because God is not a God who takes away his gifts. And so if God has gifted you the actual righteousness of Christ, the blamelessness of Christ, well, then that's what you are. So God isn't just treating you as according to something you don't possess. He's treating you according to something that he has given you and now belongs to you.
Yeah, you don't have to pretend as if you have the righteousness of Christ. No. You're not an actor on a stage, but knowing who you are in real life. No, this is actually who you are. Mm-hmm. This is actually who you are in Christ. Okay, let's move on. So verse 26 has four different couplets, four different pairings here, where we have a person described, then how God responds to that person. So with the merciful, you show yourself merciful. With a blameless man, you show yourself blameless. With the purified, you deal purely. And with the crooked, you deal, we would expect crookedly, but that's not what we have here. So with the merciful, you're merciful. With the blameless, you're blameless. With the pure, you're pure. With the crooked, you make yourself torturous. That's one way to translate this. This is, I think, just fascinating to think about how one's perspective toward God, how we stand in relation to God, we might say, affects God's standing toward us. So at the beginning of, I think it's the large Martin Luther's Large Catechism, when he talks about the first commandment, he talks about how, you know, everybody has their God, whatever they believe in. And the way that the kind of God that you believe in ends up being the kind of God you have.
Yeah.
So if I believe that God is vindictive toward me, if I believe that God is vindictive, it's not going to be any surprise if I think God is acting vindictively toward me, in other words.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you believe that God is merciful, you have no trouble seeing the mercies of God. If you believe that God is blameless, you have no problem seeing how God is blameless in all his ways. But if you believe that God is out to get you, then you ascribe all bad things to him.
Yeah, yeah, that becomes your perspective. Yeah, we see this. This crossed my mind this morning when I was looking at this verse. We see this in the way that Jesus deals with Pharisees. Mm-hmm. You know, very often they come to him and they're trying to trick him, or they're trying to trap him in his words, or they're trying to have some kind of legal argument with him, whatever it might be. And Jesus will respond in a way that's sort of similar.
Oh yeah.
So they'll say, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? And Jesus will respond to the law question with a law answer of his own. Well, what does the law say? Mm-hmm. if you want to define everything kind of legally, well then he will respond legally. That's kind of an example from the ministry of Jesus.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, what David doesn't say here is that with the crooked you are torturous, but he says that with the crooked you seem torturous.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So for the crooked man, God seems like something he's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the way that we view God becomes the way we interpret all reality, especially divine reality, the way that God acts toward us. Okay. Goes on to say, verse 28, you save a humble people, but your eyes are on the haughty to bring them down. This is another common biblical theme of God, of course, exalting the lowly and bringing down the high. And then David begins to shift to the image of military victory. So God's his lamp, he lightens his darkness. By God, I can run against a troop. I can leap over a wall. He's a shield to me, to all who take refuge in him. And then he continues this with verses 32 and following, where he picks up again the language of God being a rock and a refuge. But he describes how, like a deer, he can run on the heights. God trains his hands for war. His arms can bend this bow of bronze. He talks about a shield and God preserving him no matter where he might be, whether it's a wide place or a high place, whatever the situation might be for David. God is the one who is going to, in the midst of what David is facing, in the midst of David's battles, God is be the one who provides him with the victory and the means whereby he can gain that victory.
Yeah, what's interesting about these verses is that David, you know, we had just heard David say, I'm blameless, I'm righteous, all this stuff. But now he says that God is his strong refuge and has made my way blameless. So it's God who is responsible for this blamelessness, right? So I am blameless, but you're responsible for that blamelessness. And then I love this line where he says that you have given me the shield of your salvation and your gentleness has made me great. That's not something that you would normally think of a God, gentleness has made you great.
Yeah, I was reflecting on that this morning. The Hebrew there can go more than one way, but here's a kind of the cool thing about this. So that can be translated, that particular root can be understood as the root of a very common adjective that we have to describe those who are like lowly or meek or gentle, okay? So that Hebrew is ani. And that is the corresponding word in Greek to what Jesus uses when he says, come to me, all you're weary, heaven laden, take my yoke upon you, for I am gentle and lowly in heart. So the word here in Hebrew for gentle, the corresponding Greek to that is what Jesus uses to describe who he himself is.
Yeah, it's interesting that David, and it's encouraging, that essentially what David is saying here is, were you not a gentle God, I could not be great. I'm going to require a God who is gentle.
Yeah, it's a startling image. You would think your power has made me great. Your authority, your whatever big thing has made me big, but that's not what he does.
Yeah, if David said your power has made me great, that's true. That it's not David's power, it's God's power. But it's interesting that when he talks about his greatness, the thing that he says that he is required to be great is that he has a God who is gentle with him.
Yeah. Yeah. Reminds me of we'll probably have to end here for now. There's an old prayer that, I can't cite it word for word, but it says God's power is made known chiefly in showing mercy.
Yes.
So that's kind of that same idea. How do you really see the power of God? Well, if people would ordinarily say, well, because he like made the world or he did these great things. Actually, his power is made known chiefly when he is gentle and shows mercy and heals and saves. That's the real demonstration of his power.
That's right. Yeah. There's no weakness in being gentle and lowly.
No, quite the opposite.
Yeah. And that's
it. I thought we'd finish it, but we didn't do it.
We didn't do it. So.
We tried.
There's a lot baked into this type of passages. So we'll wrap it up next week, but we will have to stop for now. We'll see you then, Chad.
All right. See you then.